I'm going to talk about non-interactive zero knowledge. And let me start by giving a little motivation. So suppose we have two people here that are striking up a friendly chat, Iman and the devil. And during the course of this conversation, the nun informs the devil that she's a woman. And the devil, he's of course, you know, a clever guy. So, and he has his own sets of goals. So he says, "How can you leave that promise?" So now the nun, she has a problem, right? I mean, is she going to, you know, strip down or what? So, but still she wants to show this devil that, you know, she's telling the truth. And the solution is, of course, to make a zero-knowledge proof, right? So that way she convinces the devil that she's a woman, but not revealing anything else. So she reduces the statement to a circuit and makes a proof.
I guess it's very good, but let's make it a medium.
Okay, so this is about non-interactive zero knowledge, so now let me give a little more formal definition. So we want basically three properties from this proof. It should be complete, which means that if she has a witness, then she should be able to convince the verifier that the statement is true. So the setup is as follows. First, we generate a common reference string. Of course, it would be nice that we didn't have any setup whatsoever, but that's kind of a fundamental problem. Then in that case, you need interaction to have zero-knowledge proofs. So this is a relaxation of the plain model, that we have a common reference string, and everybody can see this common reference string. And now the adversary generates a circuit, which is satisfiable, and he gives a witness to the prover. Completeness says that if the prover has a witness, then she should be able to convince the verifier that the statement is true, the statement is satisfiable. Soundness says, okay, again, we generate common reference string, and now we want it to be hard for the adversary to convince the verifier about any false statement. So in other words, suppose the adversary generates an unsatisfiable circuit and a proof, and no matter how he generates that, even after seeing the common reference string, we want the verifier to reject. And finally, what does it mean to be zero knowledge? So we want to formulate that seeing a proof does not reveal any extra information than the truth of the statement. And we formalize that by having a simulator that outputs something that's indistinguishable from a real common reference string, but also gives a little secret trapdoor information about this common reference string. And gives that to the simulator. And now the adversary can come up with circuits and witnesses for it being satisfiable, and the simulator will send back a proof. And the adversary can do that as many times as he wants, and in the end he will output 0-1. And we're going to compare this game, where obviously the simulator doesn't use the witness at all, right? That's the very point. We can simulate without using the witness. We're going to compare this with the game where we do generate a common reference string correctly, and it's a prover running here. And then we say that it's zero knowledge if the adversary cannot distinguish those two games. It cannot see whether it's seeing real proofs or it's in the simulation. So that's for definitions. Now let me state the goal. What I want to do is I want to present a non-interactive zero-knowledge proof for circuit satisfiability. And so without laws of generality, we can consider a circuit which consists of NAND gates. And we want to convince the verifier that there exist wires, truth values for these wires, such that the circuit will output 1. And it's, of course, well known that circuit satisfiability is NP-complete. So take any NP language, you can reduce it to circuit satisfiability, and then use one of these analytic proofs to prove it. Okay, so the tool we're going to use for this is what I call a homomorphic proof commitment. And the idea is basically we will commit to all these values of the wires, and then we will prove that all these commitments are commitments to a satisfying assignment to the system. So this is a commitment with some special properties. We call that a commitment scheme. We generate a public key. This is a non-interactive commitment scheme. Then we can take any message, and we can commit to it, send it to the verifier. And now we're committed to the value. We cannot change the value. But on the other hand, it's also hiding that the verifier cannot see what is the value. And then later on, we can send an opening. We can reveal which randomness we use to make the commitment. And then the verifier can check, OK, that was indeed the value inside the commitment. So, and we're going to look at a special commitment scheme which has two types of public keys. So one way to set up the commitment scheme is we can set it up such that we get a perfectly hiding commitment scheme. So it's information, theoretically, no information whatsoever about the message inside the commitment. And we can actually set this up such that it also has a trapdoor commitment scheme. So if we have some special trapdoor related to this commitment scheme, to the common, to the public key, then it's possible to create commitments that we can open in many different ways to any message we like. The other way we can set up the commitment scheme is we can generate the public key such that it's perfectly binding commitment. In that case, whenever you send a commitment, there's a unique message inside. So even if you have infinite power to do bad things, you cannot open this commitment in more than one way.
You don't care about extractability here, right? For perfectly binding case, you don't insist on the
extractability can be used to build proofs of knowledge. So you could care about extractability. So this commitment scheme, so these two kind of public keys, it should be indistinguishable which choice we make. So we can set it up in two different ways, but it's not really possible to tell which way we set it up. And the idea is that if it's a perfect trapdoor scheme, then we will have perfect zero knowledge. And if it's perfectly binding, then we will have perfect soundness. Okay, so it should be homomorphic. I'm going to get back to that a little while. Also, we want to have, so this is what's new, why I called homomorphic proof commitment. We want this public key to come with a way also to make proofs about what the commitment contains. So what we want is that, suppose we set up a commitment and it contains 0, 1. Then we want it to be possible to make a proof that it contains 0, 1, but without revealing whether it contains 0 or it contains 1. And if we use a perfect binding key, then we want this witness indistinguishable proof to be perfectly sound. So there's no way if you create a commitment and you create a proof that contains 0, 1, then it does indeed contain 0, 1. There's no way you can cheat your way out of it. And on the other hand, if we use a perfectly trapdoor key, then it doesn't really make sense to say what does the commitment contain, because it can be trapdoor open to anything, so it contains any message you like. So we can imagine both an opening to 0 and an opening to 1 of this commitment. But in that case, the witness indistinguishable proof does not reveal anything about whether it's the opening of 0 or an opening of 1 that we use to make the proof.
Wait, but whoever you're proving it to doesn't know, does he know which one?
No, it doesn't.
So you're proving that either it's the first case and it's a trapdoor, or it's the second case and it's a 0, or it's the second case and it's a 1. You prove that it's one of these three things. Yeah.
So,
or did I need that understand?
Yeah, I guess that's three cases, right? I mean, either you have commitment which. So if it's a perfect binding key, right, then it could be a 0, or it could be a 1. So that's two cases. And in the third case, then it just doesn't tell whether you have a witness 0 or 1. So So the point is that, that neither party needs to know whether it's a hiding key or a binding key. This is a common reference string in non-interactive zero knowledge proof. So they're just giving this public key, and then anybody can commit the 0 or 1 and make a proof. And depending on which type of key it is, we have these two cases.
And what is the significance of super binary, you know, that the message space is not binary?
Okay, so it's kind of a technical thing, and you'll see it in a couple of slides. So it just turns out that you need, I mean, so it's homomorphic, so we have these finite abelian groups, message space and ciphertext space and randomizer space. And it turns out, for technical reason, we need the size of this group to be at least 4. Well, you can also go ahead with 3, then you need a little more complicated proof. But 2 is not enough. I mean, otherwise people would, you know, run out and use quadratic residuosity, right? Because it only contains 0 or 1. So you're kind of like done with the witness inducing proof, but it doesn't work that way. So you need just a little bit more of a message space, and then you can do non-interactive zero-knowledge proofs. Okay, I'm going to give you an example of such a commitment scheme so we have something concrete to think about. So we are going to use bilinear groups, and we are going to use them with a composite order. So this is n is some Rz modulus, right? And we can have a generator, these are cycle groups. And we have this bilinear map that we've already seen in many workshops by now. So it has this bilinearity property. And also, if you pair the generator with itself, then you get a new generator for the target group. And we're going to make the following cryptographic assumption, that we can somehow set up this kind of group such that we can choose a random element H, which has either order Q or order N. And it's impossible for an adversary to distinguish whether H has order Q or has order N. And this, of course, implies that the factorization should be hard, right? I mean, if we can factor this thing, then you can just raise H to Q and check whether it's order Q or order N. Okay. And now we can use a Bonnet-Gonism encryption scheme, which is basically like a Peterson commitment, right? We take G to M and H to R. And there are two ways we can set up the key. We can set it up such that H has order Q, in which case we have this H to R runs around the order Q subgroup. But the only thing we have in the order P subgroup is this G part, right? So M is uniquely defined modulo P. So this is a perfect binding key. The other option is to use a perfect hiding key. That's where we take H to have order N. And in that case, of course, G to M and H to R doesn't reveal anything about M, because this H thing just deletes all the information about M. So in that case, it's a standard Peterson commitment. And it's easy to see that it has this homomorphic property, right? If we take two such commitments of ciphertext and multiply them together, then we get commitment to the sum of the messages. Okay, so what's left is to prove that we have this witness indistinguished proof. And the idea is the following. So we have this commitment C, and suppose it contains 0, then of course C has order Q, right? Because then it's just H to R. So the other possibility is that C contains 1, in which case it's G to 1 and H to something, and then if we divide by G, then we have H to something, so then it has order Q as well. And that's the only two cases where we can get something that has order Q. So what we want to prove is that this pairing of C and G minus 1 C has order Q, which shows that one of them must have order Q. So we do some calculations and use this bilinearity property to move around the exponents. And what we get is that if we have an opening of C to G to 0, 1 times H to R, then we can compute a proof such that this pairing ciphertext and ciphertext by G is equal to the parent of H and the proof. So this is going to be the proof, and the verifier is just going to check that this equation holds.
So can you comment why it's indistinguishable and everything?
Yeah, I'm going to argue that now. So for now, the people do the computations and verify that it's complete, has perfect completeness. Okay, so we have to argue two things, right? I mean, first of all, if H is perfect binding key, so in other words, if H has order Q, then we want to have perfect soundness. So that's one thing to argue, and that's what we have here. Basically, you have this equation, right? I mean, ciphertext and G minus 1 times this ciphertext is equal to this thing here, so that's what we have here. And the verifier has to check that it gives H paired with the proof. And the only way that that can be possible, well, H has order Q, so this thing has order Q, right? And this is H to the R paired with something that also has order Q. So we're just left with this thing here, G paired with G raised to M and M minus 1. And this uniquely defines M times M minus 1 modulo P. So it must be 0, and therefore M must be 0 or 1 mod P. So, and then we have to argue the other thing, that if H is a trapdoor key, so if it has order N, then we want to have perfect witness indistinguishability. And the point here is that, okay, so we have this commitment, right? So we pair the commitment and commitment divided by G, and we wanted to give the pairing of H times the proof, and there's a unique proof that can be put in here, right? So no matter what witness you have, you're going to get the same proof. And therefore it's perfectly witness indistinguishable. Okay, so now we have the tool for constructing our non-interactive zero-knowledge proofs. And let's look at this circuit, right? So we want to prove that it outputs 1. We know that there are some input wires. So we're going to have a common reference string. It's basically just going to be a public key for this commitment scheme. And now we commit to the wires. And of course these, I mean, now we just see the commitment, so we have no clue what's inside. So we start by making witness indistinguishable proof that they contain 0 or 1, right? We want to commit to truth values of this y either on or off. And what's left to do is to also prove that these wires respect the NAND gates, right? So we want this one to be the NAND of these two wires, and we want one, so this should be a trivial commitment, we just use random as 0, so everybody can verify this is a commitment to the output is 1, right? So we want to prove that this is the NAND of these two wires. So what we are left with is to come up with somehow with witness indistinguishable proofs for these gates being respecting being respected by the wires. So then here's an observation. Okay, so we have these commitments. So let's look at the NAND gate, right? And we want to say that C2 contains the NAND of the content of C0 and C1. And we already have proved that they contain bits 0 or 1, so, right? So we have 3 bits B0, B1, B2. And we want to prove that B2 is the NAND of those two. So here's an observation. If you take B0 plus B1 plus 2 B2 minus 2, it belongs to 0, 1. Then B2 is the NAND of these two, and vice versa. So what we do, use homomorphic property of the commitment scheme, and we multiply these commitments this way, and then we get exactly this content, right, by the homomorphic property. And then we do a witness indistinguishable proof that it contains 0, 1, which shows that this equation is satisfied, which shows that B2 is the NAND, B0 and B1. So, and this answers your question, right? Because this is where we need the message space to have somewhat larger size than 2, because otherwise we just get overflows, and I mean we just wrap around, and we don't say anything interesting with this equation.
So what do you mean wrap around?
Okay, so suppose the message space is just has order 2, right? I mean, so
yeah.
It contains 0 or 1. Then you can come up with values with B0 and B, I mean, they will always be in 0 or 1, right? Even if it's not.
To B2, it just disappears.
Yeah,
exactly.
So you're saying if and only if it's 2, 1 is a message space beside the tree, that's
exactly. So it has to have at least size 4. And if you have size 3, then you need 2 equations. And then you can go ahead. So really, I mean, if we have this homomorphic property, we have, I wouldn't call it a large message space, but non-small message space, right? And we have these witness integers to prove, then we can use them to prove NAND gates as well. Okay, so to summarize, I mean, that's it. That's a construction, right? I mean, we commit to all the wires. For each wire, we make a witness integer proof that we have 0, 1, so it's a proper commitment to a truth value for the wire. And then we make these witness integer proofs for each NAND gate. And that's it. So, and it's easy to see, of course, we have perfect completeness, right? Because we committed to everything, so we can make these proofs. It's also easy to see that we have perfect soundness if it's a perfect binding key, right? Because then we have committed to some value, it's perfectly binding, and we know the output is 1. And the witness integer proofs show that, you know, with 100% probability, we have committed to 0, 1 in each of these wires and that they respect the NAND gates. So the circuit must be satisfiable. So, and if we wanted, if we set it up such that we actually could extract as well from this commitment scheme, then of course we can just extract all the wires and have a witness for the circuit being satisfiable.
So in real life, you just use perfect binding key, and in simulation, you use perfect wrapper key, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So what if instead if we had the perfect trapdoor key? Well, in that case, we have perfect zero knowledge. Let me just quickly try to sketch that argument. So in the simulation, what we do is, of course, we don't know the witness now, right? We have to simulate without knowing the witness. So what we do instead is we make trapdoor commitments to all these wires. And then because it's a trapdoor commitment, we can, of course, open all these wires to 0, right? So we can make witness integer proofs that they contain 0 or 1. And also because it's a trapdoor commitment, whenever we have an AND gate, right, we have this product of commitments. We can also open this product to 0 and make a witness integer proof that contains 0 or 1. So we can simulate the entire proof. And now we have to argue that the adversary cannot distinguish whether we use the witness and use the real prover key, still running on this trapdoor key, but we use the prover's method to make a proof where he uses a witness, and that we can't distinguish that from the case where we just simulate. So we use a hybrid argument for that. First of all, we can take all these commitments, and now instead of opening them to 0, we open them to the wire value and make the witness indistinguishable proof. And that's, of course, since these proofs are perfectly witness indistinguishable, that doesn't reveal anything whatsoever. I mean, you can't distinguish those two methods, whether you use simulation or this hybrid. Okay. And now we can modify this hybrid once again, that instead of making trapdoor commitments and then opening to the wire one, we can just commit to the witness right away, these wires. And since the commitments are perfectly hiding, you can't distinguish those two experiments. And this is exactly, I mean, this is how the prover works, right? It commits to the wire, and then it makes witness integer proofs. Okay, so this gives us a couple of results. First of all, what if we set it up, the scheme such that we use this perfect binding key to generate the public key, right? So we use that as the common reference string for the NISIC proof. In that case, we get a NISIC proof which has perfect completeness and perfect soundness and computational zero knowledge. So in the argument for computational zero knowledge is, of course, well, can't distinguish this from using a hiding key, and if it was a hiding key, we could perfectly simulate. And it's the really nice thing about this proof is that it's very simple, right? And the common reference string is minimal size. It's just linear in the security parameter, right? Consists of a couple of group elements and description of the group. The proof size is also very small because all these commitments, they're just commitments to the wires, so it's the size of the circuit times the security parameter. Something like this. I mean, it's even a low constant. And you can compare that with, well, there's, of course, a bunch of non-interactive zero-knowledge proofs. And in general, they achieved something like this, right? I mean, the circuit size times the square of the security parameter proofs, and usually they also have large common reference strings. And okay, so there are various trade-offs you can make here. But in general, I mean, there's nothing that competes with this kind of efficiency. Second result, okay, now let's ask the natural question. What happens if we use the perfectly hiding key instead to generate the common reference string, right? And again, we have perfect completeness. That's easy enough. And now we have perfect zero knowledge, right? So, and then we have, well, for soundness, we get something that's called, I call computational co-soundness. I'm going to do that, tell exactly what that is on the next slide. And of course, again, we have, you know, very small common reference string, very small proofs. And this is, I mean, one of the things that people didn't know how to do before. If you use the standard hidden bits model for doing non-interactive zero knowledge proofs, then you can't get out statistical zero knowledge. Okay, so what do I mean when I say co-soundness? Again, of course, I mean, the game is we generate this common reference string, and then the adversary comes up with a circuit and a proof, but now he comes up with something else. He also comes up with a witness for the circuit being unsatisfiable. And in that case, we want to always reject. So it's a little strengthening of the soundness definition, because in the soundness definition, he just has to come up with a circuit that's unsatisfiable and a proof, right? And then we want the verifier to reject. Now we say that he has to come up with a little more. He has to actually know that the circuit is not satisfiable. He has to come up with a witness that it's not satisfiable. So, and I think there are lots of cases where this is sufficient. In particular, we're able to build a universal composable non-interactive zero knowledge just from this co-soundness property. So it seems to me that maybe, I mean, the natural definition is, of course, where you don't have this witness for the circuit being unsatisfiable, but it seems to me that, I would guess that in most cases, it's enough to have this property of soundness, that it's enough that the prover just doesn't know that he proves something false.
So you can only work for language at encoding P?
Yeah.
Of course, the woman is encoding P.
Exactly.
Could you clarify the witness?
Yeah. So the problem is kind of technical. The problem is that this circuit that the adversary comes up with, it could depend on the common reference string. I mean, if he generates a circuit independently of the common reference string, then we can just switch the reference string and we can't distinguish, and then we can prove that we have soundness, right? But if it depends on the circuit, he could, for instance, come up with a statement that says, you know, this is a perfectly binding common reference string. Now you try to do this switching argument. Okay, so we say, we don't really know whether we have soundness when it's a hiding, but let's indistinguishably switch to binding string, but in that case the statement is true, right? So we can't really say that, reach any contradiction. So it seems to me that what it really is, the problem is that this circuit might say something very specific about the common reference string itself.
So just to say that I understood correctly, Kevin said that if there's any adversary that can convince the verifier to accept, it means that at least from the adversary's point of view, the thing might be satisfied. Right? I didn't get it much of sense. I guess. What a sound is it saying that nobody can cheat you, right? So here, you know, you can cheat, but you don't even know, you're not even sure if you cheated or not.
Exactly, yeah.
Once you get some kind of extraction property, do you still need this this witness, this co-soundness definition?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, so this is perfectly hiding key, right? I mean, this, we're talking about perfect zero knowledge, so you can't do any extraction.
And there's no extraction.
And of course, well, I mean, there's no problem. I mean, if we switch to perfect binding and that's extractable, then we can extract a witness, but still, it's not really enough to say anything.
Can't you like do the switch?
No, so again, if you use the perfectly binding key, then you have complete adaptive silence, and there's no need for any of this.
No, yeah, of course, I'm
right. It's only in the perfectly zero knowledge case that we can't do extraction, right? Because it doesn't make sense.
Any further questions?
Okay, I can give you an example.
Suppose I have a crypto system, right? So we have both a crypto system, we have a non-interactive zero knowledge proof, right? And I want to prove to you that the ciphertext contains particular message or has some property in this plaintext, right? In that case, I can use this proof here to prove, to convince you that it contains, has some specific property. And now, suppose I could cheat with that. Well, if you have anybody has the decryption key for this crypto system, right? Then they can extract the plain text, then they can check whether it has this property or not. So in that case, you have a witness for it being unsatisfiable. We made a journal submission, and that's where we stated. So there's no
publication. At some point, it'll show up on ePrint.
Yeah.
It should have been there already, but we forgot.
Okay. So here's another result. I'm not going to give the proof of that. So there's this universal composability framework by Canetti, right? So basically it says that we want to define security of protocols in a really malicious setting where the adversary controls scheduling of messages, can corrupt parties, there can be all kinds of protocols that run concurrently with the protocol we are running. It could be that they get really bad inputs and so forth, right? But you can still come up with some ideal definition of what should non-interactive zero knowledge be. Basically, it says that, you know, it should correspond to handing a trusted party. You know, here's the state, here's the circuit, here's the witness that is satisfiable, and then the trusted party would output, he would not reveal anything, so it's zero knowledge, right? But he would output, hey, look, this statement is true. More or less, that's how you could define it. So you can define this idealized non-interactive zero knowledge functionality in the UC framework. And what we come up with is a protocol which is non-interactive, it's statistical zero knowledge, and then it's universal composable non-interactive zero knowledge secure against an adaptive adversary. So even if the adversary can corrupt parties and can see all the randomness that they use for creating proofs and stuff, it's still universal, composable, and secure. And this is, again, something new. What people could do, they could do interactive NISIC proofs.
ZK proofs.
I'm so used to non-interactive, I don't really think about the interactive case. So you're right.
Yeah.
Good point. So, and then there was also, if we look at a non-adaptive adversary, then we could also do it. But it's the first time we get something that's universal, composable, and non-interactive zero knowledge against adaptive adversary.
So can you just say maybe like in one line where this posaunus, how is it useful? Because you said
let me see if I can state that in one line. So actually what you really need, I don't know if it's the code, okay, so what you really use is that you have the statistical zero knowledge, because that way you can open up, you can prove something about, basically what you do is you make a universal composable commitment to the witness, and then you prove something about it.
Yeah.
And you need the statistical zero knowledge property because you need to show randomness. If the adversary ever corrupts the prover, then you need to show what kind of randomness did I use to make that proof. And you can't do that with a traditional non-interactive zero knowledge proof, but in our case we can do that because it's statistical zero knowledge. So you can open up to any kind of witness. So that's why you need the statistical zero knowledge, why you couldn't do that before. And then it turns out the co-sample is enough because you make this universal composable commitment to the witness. So if the adversary ever proves something false about this witness, then you could use the extraction from the universal composable commitment to extract a witness that the adversary actually proved an unsatisfiable circuit. And I guess this is also one of the reasons that I think, you know, co-soundness is good enough, because there are no restrictions on this. I mean, this is really universal composable and non-interactive zero knowledge, right? And it shows us that we could, I mean, the UC framework, the very point is that now we can plug it into any protocol and work with it, and we have this ideal non-interactive zero knowledge functionality. Okay,
So does it mean that if you do this proofs of knowledge, I'm not sure if it makes sense, but does it mean that if you automatically do proof of knowledge, then posaunus is kind of enough, because you always, soundness automatically means that if you can prove the statement, somebody can extract the witness.
I'm not sure it makes that sense. I mean, if you have a proof of knowledge, you can extract the witness, right? So you don't really need, you know, I mean, obviously the circuit must be satisfiable, right? Because you can extract the witness.
No, what I'm saying is this seems to be what you used in the UC case, because you said, that, oh, because you use this special structure of commitment and proof.
Right. I guess you could say that, yeah. If you have somehow some other way you can extract a witness where you can actually check whether the circuit is satisfiable or not, then co-soundness is enough. Yeah. Okay, last result in this series, we have non-interactive zaps. So a zap is this thing where now we say, okay, we don't want this common reference string, right? So there's no common reference string. In that case, you can't do non-interactive zero knowledge. You can do it for trivial languages, but not non-trivial languages. And what we come up with is this construction has perfect completeness. So now there's, of course, no common reference string, but if the prover takes a circuit and a witness, he can convince the verifier that the circuit is satisfiable. On the other hand, if the circuit is unsatisfiable, then there's no proof whatsoever that will convince the verifier. And finally, now we don't have zero knowledge, but we have witness indistinguishability, right? There could be too many possible witnesses for this circuit being satisfiable. And turns out that these proofs, whether we use one witness or the other, they're computationally indistinguishable. And the naive idea is, of course, that the prover chooses public key and makes a non-interactive zero-knowledge proof. And that doesn't work because there's nothing that prevents the prover from choosing a trapdoor key and then can simulate proofs. But here's another idea. So instead of choosing one public key, choose two public keys that are correlated with one another, and make a non-interactive zero-knowledge proof with each of these keys, right? And then if we can somehow, the verifier can verify that he doesn't know which key, I mean, is the trapdoor key or is a binding key, he may not know that, but if we can just verify that one of them is perfectly binding, then we get perfect soundness, right? Because one of the proofs must be made with a perfect binding key. So we get perfect completeness, we get perfect soundness if we can set it up this way. Now let me argue that we get witness indistinguishability, right? So here we use this property that you cannot tell which of the keys is a trapdoor key. And the idea is the following, right? So we generate two keys and make a non-directed zero knowledge proof with both of them. And let's select the first one to be a perfect trapdoor. And of course, by the non-directed zero knowledge property, we might as well have used witness one to make this proof instead of witness zero. Okay, so now we can switch and use the other one as a trapdoor, right? So now we make Nizek proofs with witness one and witness zero on the second one, but now this is trapdoor, so we can switch to using witness one. And now we switch back again, and now we have exactly the proof where we're using witness one. So this is a hybrid argument. There's no way you can distinguish anybody here. So it's the same whether we used witness zero in both proofs or witness one in both proofs. So what's left is, of course, just come up with some way to set up this kind of commitment scheme. And it turns out that we don't really know how to do it with the BGN, because in the BGN construction, you have this H which has order Q, and you can't really check whether it's one or the other. We don't know how to guarantee that you get at least one H which has order Q. So we're going to use some different kind of scheme for that. So anyway, so we use this verifiable public keys, right? So we know one of them is perfect binding, the other one is trapdoor, and it's just indistinguishable which one is the trapdoor key. In that case, we're going to get a non-interactive ZAP, which again has really small proofs. And you can compare that, well, Dworkin and Nawar were the ones who introduced ZAPs, but that was a two-move construction, used general assumptions, so the assumptions are somewhat better than what we have, but then again, there was also a giant size proof. Barak, Ong, and Vardan used de-randomization techniques to make a non-interactive ZAP, so they both had a de-randomization assumption. And of course, also when you use de-randomization techniques, you blow up even more, so it's even bigger proof. So our contribution is really to take, you know, a standard cryptopolynomial cryptographic assumption and make really short proofs.
So in particular, you don't have to repeat things many times. I mean, in that there is a generic construction of work and over where it repeats as many easy.
Well, I guess we do it twice. Okay. So the idea behind this proof is again to use bilinear groups. This time we're going to set it up with a prime order group, and the reason for doing that is that if we work with prime order groups, you can actually verify that something is prime and prime sign P, right? So it's possible to verify that everything is a good group. And you can also easily verify what elements belong to the group or not. So in that case, the prover can set up something that verifiably is a bilinear group with a bilinear map and so forth. And we're going to use a decisional linear problem. So we're going, basically that's an extension of the decision Diffie-Hellman problem. So we have three random generators for the group, and then we have U, V, and W, such that we take the first generator and raise to R, the second and raise to S, and we have T is the sum, possibly the sum of these two R and S, or it's just chosen at random. And we say that we cannot distinguish whether it's one or the other case we are looking at. And of course, this is, I mean, if you just deleted these two guys, right, then you had the decision Diffie-Hellman, so it's natural extension. Decision Diffie-Hellman doesn't work in bilinear groups. So what we do, we create this commitment scheme. We take U to the message, V to the message, W to the message, and take F to R, H to S, and G to R plus S. How much time? Oh, I want to talk about something else, so I think I'll go very quickly through this thing here. Okay, so we get, if T is equal to R plus S, then you just get a linear tuple here. So this thing is the sum of these two exponents, and it's easy to make a perfect trapdoor. And on the other hand, if t is not equal to apples s, then we are uniquely binding to m. And homomorphic property, easy to see. Witness indistinguishability. I'm going to skip why it's witness indistinguishable. It's a little technical, so you'll have to read that critical paper. And just an example of, okay, so here's the trick, right? We set up a group somehow with bilinear map, choose public keys for this group, and now we output two public keys, right? Which is basically the same string, so all this is verifiable, that it's a bilinear group, and these are elements in the group, and so forth. But there are two, here we have W, and here we have W times G, right? Now there are two possibilities, right? Okay, so we want to argue that one of them is perfectly binding. And it's perfectly binding when T is not equal to R plus S. And of course here, well, if this one had R plus S, then this one has R plus S plus 1, and it's not R plus S. So it's perfectly binding here. On the other hand, if this one is R plus S, then this is R plus S minus 1, and this one is perfectly binding. So this way we can verify that one of them is perfectly binding, but by the decision linear assumption, we can't tell which one it is. Because, yeah, the problem is that we need H to be of order Q in the perfect binding case, and there's no way to verify that we have this order Q element, right? We can't distinguish it from an order N element. Okay, so this is the first talk, but I'm going to give you a bonus talk. So, and you said I had plenty of time, right?
We're plenty equal to 10 minutes.
Okay, right. Okay, so this is joint work with Rafi. And we call it cryptography in the multi-string model. And the problem is the following. So suppose we have this common reference string model, right, that I talked about before. And in common reference string, we have the parties that get a common random string. And now you can do things that you couldn't do in plain model, right? So you can do non-interactive zero knowledge proofs. And you can do multi-party computation with honest minority. And you can do universal composable commitments. A lot of nice things that you don't know how to do. And the problem that we looked at is the following. Where does this common reference string come from? Right? I mean, it has to pop up somewhere, and it seems like it's unreasonable a setup assumption. Is it some trusted party that generates a common reference string? That's one option, but who are you going to trust? Another possibility would be that you use multi-party computation to set up a reference string, but if you do a non-interactive zero knowledge, it doesn't really make sense to, you know, first do interaction to set up a confident reference string and then make the proof. And might as well have used an interactive zero knowledge proof in the first place. So Rafi had this idea. So instead, let's use the multi-string model, right? So what we imagine is that, suppose we're in an internet setting or something like that, we have a bunch of authorities, and they choose random strings and make them available. And now the users, they can take set of these common reference strings, and we assume that some of them are honest, right? And then you can do, for instance, non-interactive zero knowledge in this model. And the assumption is now that some of them are honest, but we're not guaranteed that all of them are honest. So we're not putting all our eggs in one basket. We're not trusting one authority to create a common reference string. Instead, we just hope that out of a set of authorities, some of them are honest. So I think there are really good arguments for this being a good model. First of all, there's no single trusted authority, right? So it's much more reasonable security assumption. It seems also that it's a little self-enhancing, right? I mean, if we have a single common reference string that people might go and use, then we could easily imagine, you know, some system administrator saying, okay, I'm going to create a common reference string for non-interactive zero knowledge proof. Let me create it so I can extract which witnesses they're using, right? And then we could learn a lot of bad things about it. So, and now it seems like, you know, if we have some resilience towards single corrupt adversaries, there actually needs to be many that are corrupted for him to break, then he has to go out and cooperate with something else. And now he's not honest but curious anymore. Now he really has to, you know, risk going to somebody else and say, should we cooperate? So it seems like there's much less incentive to create bad common reference strings in the model. So we kind of like, if we work, look at this, you know, internet setting where we have servers that provide common reference strings, then it seems like there's much less incentive to create a bad string, so we will have less fraction of bad strings, and that again enhances our scheme. Also, it's nice in the sense that the burden on authorities is really minimal. They just have to output a random string, right? It's not like they need to know who else is running this protocol or what it's going to be used for, anything like that.
They have to use their coins, right, that they use to generate.
But it's a random string. So they publish everything.
Are you talking about uniform random string or
yeah.
Public type?
You can do both models. I'm talking random string here. So, but otherwise, yeah, there's an issue with deleted coins. And also, I mean, it's nice in the sense that it handles adaptive corruption, right? I mean, suppose an adversary hacks into one of these authorities. It's not like he's going to learn anything. It's a random string and everything's public. So he doesn't learn anything from hacking in. And okay, he might replace a string, but again, that's also something we have resilience to. I mean, the sum of the strings are bad, that's okay, we can handle that.
So do you assume, I'm just saying, so technically, you know, you can have deterministic extractors if you have like, I don't know, 20 strings among which at least half are random, if you just deterministically extract one good random string, do it work for you or not?
Yeah, I think, okay, so, but I think, we'll still have to make a simulation argument, and I'm not sure that these, you know, when you do this extraction, right, then it's not clear yet you can do the extraction and somehow still have, you know, that it's a simulation string.
You can just XOR them, right? But still it's not clear how to simulate.
Well, you can't XOR them because then you might see some strings, right? And then you corrupt the last guy and you put out XOR to whatever you want.
Right.
So you can't really do that either.
Still you need something for the trapdoor, right?
Yeah, right. And I'm going to get back to that.
But I have a question. What if different runs are with different strings? Can you tell me about that?
Huh?
What if there's like several different runs of protocols?
I think that depends probably a little on the application. I think you can set up most of the stuff with the same set of strings.
No, but that seems bad to me that you have to count on the same string each day.
Okay, right. I mean, it's not like I'm assuming that everybody, I mean, suppose we have a bunch of random strings. Might very well be that I go ahead and I take a bunch of strings and I go make a non-interactive zero knowledge proof to somebody else. And it might well be, so then later on I want to prove something to some other person, then I go take a different bunch of random strings and I prove it.
And it will still be okay.
And it will still be okay, yeah. Okay, so first thing we look at is multi-string non-interactive zero knowledge. So the idea here is we have three algorithms as before. We have a common reference string generator, and that's very simple, it just outputs a random string. Now the prover, instead of taking one random string, takes a set of random strings. So actually n can vary, it's not, it doesn't have to be fixed. So depending on the circumstances, you can decide how many strings he needs. And then again, we have the statement, the witness, and creates a proof. And the verifier takes these strings, X and the proof, and accepts or rejects. And now to define non-interactive zero knowledge. Well, we have, first of all, our construction has perfect completeness. So even if the adversary generated all the strings, the prover will still be able to convince the verifier. So, and then for soundness, what we do is basically a threshold definition. So we say that if TS of the strings are correctly generated, then we have soundness. So here we have an adversary. He has access to a string generation oracle. So he can generate as many strings as he wants, and then he can cherry pick which ones he likes. I mean, maybe he likes strings with many zeros and something like that. And he can also inject fake strings that he just chooses himself. He can generate up to TS minus one fake strings, right? And then he gives that, outputs that, and he outputs a proof. And then we say that still the verifier should reject if X is not in the language. And for zero knowledge, well, here we have also a threshold definition, so this is DZ. And again, we have the simulate outputs, reference strings and trapdoors. So, and then the simulator, what it does, it chooses set of these strings. And if it has TZ string of the strings that the adversary chose, then it can simulate the proof. So if TZ strings are generated as we want to, then we can simulate proofs.
So there is an adversary between as one as two, so there is an adversary who observes some of them.
Yeah, so I'm giving you the definition right now. So, okay, so what we do is we take the traditional zero-knowledge definition, plus we split it up into two parts. It seems simpler to define it that way, and it's actually a stronger definition. So what we say is, first of all, there should be indistinguishability between the reference strings, right? I mean, so either we choose them at random, or we simulate the reference strings, but we can't distinguish whether it's simulated or a random reference string. So that's one point. And then the second is that suppose now the adversary, so he has access to this generation of reference strings, and suppose he picks some set of strings such that TZ of them are honest, are generated according to this protocol. In that case, you can simulate the proof and he can't tell the difference. So, and observe here, we're giving him access to the simulation, so actually he knows the trapdoors for all these strings as well. Even in that case, he can't tell the difference between proofs. So that's in the standard zero knowledge definition, right? He has access to some oracle. He can see simulated proofs, and even after that, he should not be able to simulate. Here, he can just simulate with proofs himself. So that's why it's a stronger definition. Okay. So, and first, here's an observation. We have a lower bound. So, if TS plus TZ smaller than N, then the language we're making Nisick proofs for must be in p-poly. So we have to require that TS plus DZ is bigger than N. And of course, at the same time, we want to minimize both of them, right? So this is a trade-off, right? We want, of course, to have soundness, so we want TS to be as small as possible. We want to have zero knowledge, so we want TZ to be as small as possible. So, and depending on the situation, you can want them to be different, or you can just choose them to be larger than N, half both of them. Here's a simple construction of a multi-string Nisick proofs. So basically, we say in the proof that we have common reference strings that contain random value and an initial measure for that. So this is this two-move witness indistinguishable proof. And then what the prover does is he makes zaps with all these common reference strings that X is an L or DZ of these things have been generated pseudo-randomly. And in that case, if we want to simulate, of course, he knows TZ of these things are pseudorandom, he can make that proof. And otherwise, he makes this one, and you can't distinguish, so therefore it's zero knowledge. And by the way, this is an example where non-interactive zaps are good, because then we don't need to make n zap, then we just make one zap, and we don't need that camera. Right. Okay, so there are a lot of more advanced Nisick proofs you can do. Also, we can use it with bilinear maps. Turns out that this is a really complicated thing. The problem is all these random strings are generated independently. So there's no agreement on a group, right? I mean, we want to use a bilinear group somehow, but we can't do that because they all have, I mean, even if the authority set up groups, or the prover sets up the group, they might choose different groups, the prover might choose his group maliciously. So it turns out it's really tricky, and I'm quite happy to see that we actually got a really nice result, that we can get proofs which have this size, n, so that's the number of reference string, and usually that will be really small, right? And then we have the size of the circuit times k, which is the current parameter. So, and since n is really small, this matches the constructions we have in the common reference string model.
So all your constructions satisfy, they have the optimal threshold, ts plus tz equals n plus 1?
Yeah, they can, actually you can choose any tz and t.
So as long as it's
Okay, so the UC framework. So what we can do, we can also do multi-part computation, this multi-string model. So what we do is we define, okay, UC framework very quickly. It says the following. If we have this really bad environment, we have the adversary can corrupt parties, can schedule meshes and so forth. And then we compare that, this protocol that parties are running, with an ideal functionality, right? So that specifies that, you know, basically they hand the inputs to a trusted party, which gives them the outputs. And he doesn't reveal anything, so perfectly secure. So we compare those two, and we say that a protocol securely realizes the functionality if the environment cannot tell whether it's the adversary running protocol or the simulator running this ideal function. So here's some example of functionalities. Common reference string functionality, right? That's a simple one. Take a random string, output it to everybody. Commitment functionality. So here, party inputs a message to the functionality. And the functionality can later on, so this functionality just tells everybody, hey, this guy committed to something. Doesn't tell what the commitment was to. And later on, we can open this commitment to any message. And finally, we have this multi-string functionality. So, and here the idea is, okay, so the simulator can ask the functionality for a random string. And he can do that as many times as he wants. And then after that, he can cherry pick which random strings he wants to use. He can also inject some fake ones. And this functionality says, okay, I mean, if there's too few strings that are generated itself, then it's going to reject. But if it, more than half of them are generated by the functionality, then it outputs that to everybody else. So now they have a set of strings, but a majority of the strings are OK. Okay, so here's the result. So if we take any well-formed functionality, then it turns out that we can realize this in multi-string models. So this is CLS showed that you can realize any well-formed functionality in the common reference string model. What we show is that, okay, if we relax the setup, so this multi-string model, then we can realize any well-formed functionality. So, and it's really against the strongest possible adversary that, you know, can corrupt parties adaptively, learn the entire history, they can't delete anything. Here's the proof of the result. So CLS showed that if we have a common reference string, then we can realize any well-formed functionality. So what we show then is that if we have commitment functionality, then we can realize the common reference string functionality. That's just a standard conflicting protocol. Everybody commits to random value, everybody reveals, and they take the XOR of these strings, right? And finally, turns out that this commitment functionality can be realized in the multi-string model. And the idea there is to use a combination of threshold secret sharing. So what you do is you take an n sharing of the secrets, and then you treat each common reference string as a commitment string. And you make a commitment with that to that thing. So you make a bunch of commitments. And since you have this threshold secret sharing, you have resilience towards some of the strings being bad. You don't reveal anything because it's threshold shared. And also, you have to reveal all the shares in the end, so you can't really change your mind about what value you're using. Okay, so yeah, just to summarize, right? I mean, I think the main thing is we introduce this multi-string model, and then we kind of like argue that this is a really cool model because, look, first of all, we can do non-interactive zero knowledge, where you just, you know, go ahead and prove something. And also, yeah, you have universal composable commitments, which, you know, now we have the multi-string model where we can do that instead of just doing it in the common reference string model. And finally, this implies that we can do multi-party computation in the multi-string model.